All right. Well, delighted to be here and talking about things that can go wrong with laboratory information systems. I got into this topic and discovered that I'm going to be able to talk about 2% of what might go wrong. But these are just some of the more interesting and amusing things that I've seen go wrong recently. And you just, you just have to take it with a grain of salt. Know that that you try to build systems in to prevent these things from going wrong, or at least to recognize them quickly after they have. So these are the learning objectives that were in the, abstract that basically just said you got to have a strategy for how you're going to do it, deal with it. How do you deal with HL7? Some of the atypical data you might see coming out of commercial lab systems, and some tools that could be put in place to prevent these errors from causing damage, or at least more damage than they already have. So I'm going to summarize some examples where implementations have gone wrong, but I think this would be an even more useful presentation, and it's obviously a very short time. But if those of you in the audience who have anecdotes about things that have gone wrong, chime in and let, perhaps during the question period, but or even earlier on, it would be really, I think we learn more, we are able to do a better job with these systems by being able to predict things that need to be prevented. So generally we're dealing in my section with two different categories of data. The identified disease cases that are on the left-hand side, the findings in large populations, such as syndromic surveillance and so on, they're on the right-hand side. I'm really going to be concentrating just in the diagnostic laboratory findings, but it's worthwhile keeping in mind that we're operating within a much larger milieu and looking at a lot of different data types within our shop. So we have systems to support all of these, to support many of these at this point. We have a bit of a challenge in that we're a rather large county, especially in terms of population, and this week, especially in terms of smoke density. We have a lot of physicians. We have many, many laboratories, mostly small doctor's office type labs, but it's hard to keep track of all of those. Over 100 hospitals, and a dwindling number with emergency departments, and several sizable independent labs. So how do we connect to all of these providers to get laboratory data? We looked at the most common laboratory information systems that serve hospitals and labs in Los Angeles County, and found that the ones that one would expect in terms of laboratory information systems, Cerner, Meditech, SunQuest, McKesson has a whole smattering of different types of system, all called McKesson now, and so on, and some that you may not have heard of. So our strategy has been largely that we want to recruit laboratories. We gave a talk last year which really focused on recruitment, and I'd urge you to consult that, or I could send you a copy if you don't have it, whether it's staffing or incentives. Also, what tools we use to implement, and we really focused on working with LIS vendors rather than working with laboratory by laboratory basis, but really looking at a vendor across all of the sites that run a given vendor system in the county. Well, labs have many compelling reasons not to participate, and especially if a program doesn't include business or revenue, you really don't have much chance in getting in the queue. Even if we pay for the cost, you still have to have this project contend with a huge backlog of other projects that the lab IT staff is trying to do. And, they'll ask you, why can't you just, we'll send you an extract once a week. Well, there's a lot of problems with that, and we really try to discourage that approach. Sometimes public health is our own worst enemy. Our folks, our friends over at STD or immunization or tuberculosis, especially lead, has gone into the lab and beat them up to send data in a particular proprietary format, very laborious. And they say, we don't want to do more of that. Well, we say, well, that's not what we're talking about. Well, you start out behind to begin with. How do you light a fire under these folks? Well, that's hard. Funding is helpful. If you can provide, we'll reimburse your costs in interface costs or so on. We provide labor, that is, we do the Loink and SNOMED coding and help set up the dictionaries in their LIS and so on. But your jurisdiction may or may not be able to do that. It's helpful if there's a law that they're supposed to do it, but it doesn't necessarily make them do it. However, Mississippi has an approach I heard about last night that I think is really helpful. That is, the hospital knows that its license will get yanked if it doesn't send data. I think they're going to get cooperation, but anyway. So for the partners that are not eager, a number of states have now passed laws, and J.A. Magnuson just put together the results of the 2008 survey about all of the states that have passed laws. And so we'll see that in our state in the next couple of years. But what can go wrong? Well, lots of things can go wrong. I mean, I told you to begin with what can go wrong in terms of labs simply not wanting to cooperate, not being able to cooperate. But then you get it set up, and, well, guess what? Rapid reporting can be a mixed blessing. How complete is the reporting, really? How is it formatted? Are you getting the result types you think you are? Oh, rapid reporting. We implemented a long time ago with a large HMO laboratory, and wonderful, they got the results immediately. Then we found that our district nurses were sometimes contacting the patient before the patient had heard from the physician. This was not good PR. So eventually what we did was we built a 23-hour delay into this interface, which we said, well, it's, you know, you don't want to delay results, but at the same time you don't want to have physicians being upstaged by the public health nurse. A better solution was, I think, suggested by a colleague earlier this week at this meeting, and that was, shouldn't the public health nurses just have a policy to contact the primary physician, a kind of common courtesy, to discuss the case before contacting the patient? Now, I haven't raised this with our public health nurses to see if they're willing to do that, but it makes sense to me. Well, what is HL7? That's a good question. What's conveyed by an HL7 message that has no optional fields? This is a quiz. Anyone want to venture? What is conveyed by an HL7 message with no optional fields? Well, what? Nothing. One of the pioneers of HL7 told me this a few years ago. He said, Ray, you know, if you don't have any optional fields in a message, it has no information in it. So, and then what kinds of different result types do you get through the message? Numeric results, well, mostly we think we know how to handle those. But titers, well, how's a titer represented? And different labs report it, you know, maybe they'll have a colon in it or just a number or so on. And you need to be sure that your software can handle that and understand what is coming. Is the result abnormal? Well, there's an OBX8 field that's supposed to say normal, abnormal, but, well, lots of times it doesn't. Either because the lab system can't tell whether it's normal or abnormal. The tech really didn't tell the lab system what kind of result this was. So, and that causes some havoc, and you've got a system that says, I'm only going to send abnormal results. And then text codes and comments are represented all kinds of marvelous different ways. And sometimes you have results sitting in note segments, and you have comments sitting in OBX5s, so, and all of the above. So they do represent results in marvelous different ways. You know, there is, in fact, one of the most wonderful formats from the technologist and physician's point of view that one of the popular laboratory information systems uses. And you basically, as a tech or a doc, you can take a comment code and a result and another comment code, and you can string them all together with dashes, and you can make the report look exactly like you want it to on your own internal, you know, laboratory report or your physician laboratory report. But when it comes across to public health, it looks like hash. And so how do you sort that out? You know, some LSs continue to use obsolete tools. They're one of the more widely installed systems is still running in COBOL. Everybody has homegrown dictionaries. A few years ago, I ran into people in public health that didn't understand that laboratories, they don't use any kind of standard code for tests? No. For results? No. And the Lunkin Stomat ideas are kind of an add-on. And there's all kinds of communication challenges with computer communications. Some LISs are smarter. They're able to select out reportables to translate and into Stomat and Lunk and then transmit that in a secure way to the public health server. Others can only dump a raw HL7 file of everything. Potassiums, glucoses, salmonella, all in the same file. And some even have difficulty with that. This is a very informal classification of levels saying, you know, if you're a level 3 system, you can, within the laboratory information system, you can filter, you can translate to Lunk and Stomat, and all of that's driven by tables within the LIS. And right now, SunQuest has that capability, LabCorp, Quest has that capability. I guess I should add Mayo to this that I learned about at this meeting. If there may be some systems out there that do just filtering. And in fact, one of the national commercial labs was at that point until just recently, where they could filter out lab reportables or public health reportables, but they didn't do SNOMED translation on the system. And then you get down to systems that can basically, if you're lucky, if they can, dump all results in HL7 format. And we found that both flavors of Meditech and both flavors of Cerner, we were eventually able to get to a situation where they were able to dump HL7 that we could then do something else with. Yeah?
I'll just jump in here to say that we're getting Cerner data like it's SNOMED coded and filtered, and we're getting Quest data without like it's SNOMED coded.
Oh, well.
Just goes to show you.
Is it coming, is it Lunk and Stomat and filtered in the Cerner box? Mm-hmm. They claim that wasn't, they didn't have that software. So, oh well. Obviously, one of the things we discover, even within a locality, is, you know, we have Meditech running at 10 sites or something, 15 sites. And in fact, you know, in many cases, they're running what's supposed to be the same software release. But when you send out, when you look at the HL7 that comes out, it's different. So, oh well. That's interesting. I'll have to find out how. Yeah. Any rate, so these are some of the models. The top model there is you've got a laboratory information system that has the ability to filter, translate, and then secure the packet and transport it off to public health. In the middle, you have an LIS that only can dump the HL7, and then you've got to do filtering and security, or either filtering, translating, and transmitting. In an intermediate, what we call an edge server or an ELR gateway or various other names. Okay, just a few anecdotes. People wonder what the, sometimes people call these things that you don't like about systems bugs, but sometimes they're also called undocumented features. And the classic example of that was an IBM mid-range computer in the 1960s, turned out there was a certain sequence of keys you could hit on the console that would erase the entire disk drive. And this was a real problem in those days because reloading that beast was a problem. So what did they do? Did they fix this? No, they didn't fix it. They documented it. If you want to erase the entire disk drive, hit this sequence of keystrokes. So. Okay. Then there's another phrase that I sometimes hear that I dread called working as designed. The problem with working as designed is, this is how it is stated. The fact that this module is totally unusable is unfortunate, but it does exactly what the ESL speaking programmer in offshore Arabia thought the specification meant. And the antidote to that is a technique known as rapid prototyping or agile design, where you basically go through 200 or 300 iterations where you see various versions of the software as it's progressing each day or two and make sure that it's really progressing in the right direction. HL7 standard, after 18 months of trying, one of the LIS vendors we were dealing with finally admitted, our company doesn't actually have an HL7 standard interface. It has a vendor name standard interface. So we hope at least from one site to another of that vendor it looks the same. It doesn't look like HL7, but oh well. Okay, and some of you have heard these words. Anyone know what telalgia means? Some of you have heard this recently, but those of you, you don't, anyone want to dissect the word? It sounds like somebody might have figured it out. What? That's right. TLA is a three-letter acronym, and then what's the rest of the word?
Pain.
Pain, exactly. Algia. You know, neuralgia, arthralgia, whatever. It's pain induced by overuse of three-letter acronyms, which we have a lot of in this field. And then there's phalalgia, which is pain induced by four- and five-letter acronyms. So, well, Loinc, you know, one of my favorite quotations is, the wonderful thing about standards is we have 300 glucose codes to choose from. Now, fortunately, we don't have to send glucose to public health, but my approach to this is say, hey, choose any code that looks about right for this test that goes to public health, and just make sure public health knows to look for that test along with that Loinc code along with the others when they're putting it into the disease dictionary. SNOMED, many of us were disappointed when it was really, we couldn't find a SNOMED code for H1N1 novel flu within the weeks after the outbreak began. And it turns out that's not actually an intrinsic defect of the SNOMED system. It was the fact is we don't know about the mechanisms for rapidly setting up codes or for setting up our own local codes in a proper way. And there are both mechanisms for both of those things that we just haven't learned about, so we need to publicize so the next time we'll be able to get a code quickly for that. We had Loinc codes within a few days, but the SNOMED folks are, well, they're married. Okay, another terminology problem we run into is we remember that you're connecting with laboratory information systems. A lot of people make the mistake of thinking that we're using laboratory information management systems. If you're a research or a pharmaceutical lab, yeah, that's the kind of system you use. And in some cases, some of those systems that have worked in pharmaceutical labs have moved into public health labs and have been, after much work, been made to work. But the clinical applications are oriented somewhat differently, and those are really laboratory information systems. Okay, how do you learn more about laboratory information systems? Well, there's a magazine called CAP Today that you can get, or you can just pull it down from the cap.org website, and has lots of information on these. There's various conferences, talk to your colleagues, etc. Well, this is a question I get a lot from my epidemiologist colleagues. However, the various special characters at the top are replaced with something I can't say here. But why can't we get address from these labs? They're not doing their job. You know, they should send us the address. Well, you know, it is essential for assigning it, even to know that it's in our right jurisdiction, that it doesn't belong across the border in the other state or the other county, and to make sure it gets to the right team. We want to make sure statistics are right, and that public health staff can contact the patient to follow up. But you know, I've even got the comment of, you know, there's this one lab that we really don't get many patient addresses from, so why don't we just turn off ELR? And I said, well, we can. I mean, you really want to go back to paper? I mean, they won't be, the addresses won't be on the paper, but it's just less obvious. So one terminology to be clear on, laboratories typically do supply demographics. That is, they supply patient name and birth date. They just don't supply address. Now, and clinicians have this in their office records, but unfortunately, laboratories often don't have it. They never get it. If they're a hospital lab, it's over in the admitting system, but it never sent to the hospital lab. If it's a busy lab, maybe it's on the requisition, they didn't type it in. Well, that's something that's amenable to some correction. Maybe they have two login processes, and at the front end, type in just the patient name and birth date and not tell a day or two later that they put in all the rest of the stuff on the requisition. And by the time they've sent us the results, only the name is in, and maybe they're going to send us another transmission a day later with the address, but our systems can't handle that second transmission. Unfortunately, in reference lab situations, we're like a hospital lab sends to a national reference lab. Very often, the requesting lab doesn't get the patient. The requesting lab doesn't send the patient address to the performing lab. And we really need to add to the reference lab interface between the hospital lab and the reference lab sending the patient address. So these are just some address ways of addressing it. I think I'm going to have to skip past this pretty quick. Am I right? Okay. So the hospital lab, you know, if we need to, we have a feed already between the admitting system and the hospital system. We need to add address to that feed. Maybe you could get a feed from the hospital system and the lab system and collate somewhere, but that's kind of painful to do. So we kind of think the first approach is better. And make sure that if you do get address on a piece of paper, you put it in the computer. So we want to be sure that the requirements for those interfaces between the referring laboratory and the referral laboratory that receives the reference work includes the address. In fact, in some states, I heard about the New Jersey law recently that actually requires the referring laboratory to provide the patient address. So if it's missing, if they get a, if New Jersey gets a lab report from say Quest or some referral laboratory, reference laboratory, then they would contact the hospital who sent it and say, hey, you didn't give us the address, what is the address? Rather than bugging Quest, who obviously doesn't have the address. And then we need to make sure that our public health software, the ELR software, is able to take those two transactions where one day we get the result so we can start acting on it if we want to. If it's a meningitis, I want to start acting on it. But, you know, if it's a hepatitis, I'll probably wait till, or, you know, hepatitis B or something, I'll wait until I get that second transaction that gives me the address so I can have more complete information. But your software has to be able to handle those two transactions. And then dealing with the recalcitrant providers, getting a kind of a letter from your state public health officer that the lab can provide to physicians if they don't seem to understand that address really is required. And it's not a letter from the lab, it's a letter from the state health department or county health department. So what about patients living in other jurisdictions? And I know there were some talks earlier today on this same topic. We really would like to see that anytime an ELR jurisdiction gets a transaction that belongs to somebody else, another jurisdiction, that we be able to send it electronically. Or maybe send it to a kind of an umbrella unit like the state of California in our case to redistribute it to the appropriate jurisdiction. In the short term, we hope that laboratories only will have to build interfaces to a single public health agency. And that public health agency will then route the transactions to whoever it belongs to. In the longer term, maybe, and that's within a state, but maybe in the long term, that could be a nationwide thing. So if I've got it like a Cedars-Sinai Medical Center that sees patients from all over the Western US, if they send me a reportable disease for salmonella for somebody who lives in Colorado, I could pick that up and send it off to Colorado automatically. Well, ELR is not a static process. Unfortunately, things keep getting keep changing in laboratories, and errors are made. One of the really annoying things about computers is that they do exactly what they're told to do. I mean, they're not smart enough to realize that what you just told it to do was a really dumb thing. And so you've got to have an ongoing quality assurance process. And, you know, did the lab remember to add the new test to the reportable table? When they added a patient location, did they add that location to the list of locations for which reports need to go to public health? And you say, well, shouldn't all locations be reported? Well, no. I mean, if it's a CAP a QA sample, you really don't want that report going off to public health. And there's some other exceptions. So there is this feature in many LISs, and you may have to make sure that when you add new clinics, you add them to the table to report to public health. We had one case, and I think I'll mention more, where they added some new clinics, and months later we discovered that all the positive hepatitis cases from those clinics had not been reported to public health. So Quality assurance what I'll do is these slides will be on the web, so I'd suggest you read them there in terms of the detail. But the general idea is we get we're now getting a dump of all of the test codes from every laboratory that is, or starting with a few, it will eventually be every laboratory that we deal with. And then we get such a dump every 3 months or so. We then run an automated compare and say, okay, now versus 3 months ago, have you added any new test codes? And if you have, do they look like tests that we ought to be getting in public health? And if so, did you add them to the table? And you have to be that explicit, otherwise you have things kind of wandering around and not getting reported. And just about the automated tools and so on. Another way is to do some random audits, and we don't really know how effective this will be. At the moment, our random audit is that we get a case that comes reported through our regular communicable disease physician reporting system, like a salmonella, and it didn't come through ELR, and we say, what happened? Okay, so we focus on the laboratory information system vendor in terms of working with them to get the transmission working properly. We provide the filtering and so on if necessary in an intermediate box. Recognize that HL7 is not a standard. We basically, really try to help people in the hospital understand why it is we're doing this. You know, there's a lot of different ways to obtain test catalog codes. You need to get a machine-readable table of the entire test catalog, and you have to be able to clarify Snoink and SNOMED. There's various ways of getting demographic data and addresses, a whole bunch of different ways of connecting in a secure way. Make sure that you pay attention if something looks awry. And then, the whole talk could be given on whether you use an LIS resident filter or you have this separate ELR gateway or edge server. Our choices were basically dictated by the fact that some vendors just didn't have the capability of doing the job on the box. And we really were delighted to work with the laboratorians because they really go bend over backwards to make sure they're sending us the data in a very timely and accurate way. And that's very good. I think that's okay. And that's my email, and thank you.
Great, thank you.
Questions? Other things that go wrong? Please. I know there are many things that go wrong. Maybe you're embarrassed to say, but or questions.
I'll ask a question, right?
Yeah.
Have you used any laboratory licensing approaches to maintain? Well, one of the suggestions that we've had is to incorporate choosing a sample of records
when you go out for your annual laboratory licensing evaluation, which happens annually in our state, and getting those folks to pull the data to allow you to ascertain whether you've got missed cases.
I've heard of that. I believe New York also uses that approach, I think, yeah. We're the great state of Los Angeles County. We don't have that close a linkage with the folks in Berkeley that do the laboratory license. I think it's a good idea, but we're not at the moment haven't gotten there. I think it's something we'd want to do eventually. Yes.
Thanks, Ray. Everything was great. I've seen it all personally. A suggestion, though.
Yeah. Okay.
100 years ago, when I did STD laboratory visitation program, we printed out in crude ways data tables that we would actually bring and present to the lab directors of what we had received in the intervals since our last visit, as a way to show that we're looking at them and thank them for that. But we now have automated ways to do that, and maybe instead of sort of saying what you're not doing right, it would be nice to say some things about what you are doing right as well in automated ways.
So. Oh yeah, I think, I agree. The question, what you are doing right, and really most of our emphasis in ELR is what you are doing right, but once in a while, it's helpful to look at some of the things that can go wrong. But I agree with that because we've had a huge huge increase in volume of our electronic laboratory reporting, or of laboratory reporting since we've put in this system, and I think on the whole it's been a very positive thing. But good point. Yes.
Ray, if you guys build lab fails and maybe days go by without getting any lab tests, can you figure out a way to send an alarm off?
Yeah, we have a number of aberration detectors. Their names are Sue. And actually there are also automated systems within our interface that say if we haven't received a transmission within a certain number of hours, then a flag is tripped and the system maintenance person calls us or emails us and said we haven't seen anything for a while. So we have a number of mechanisms. I'm sure we can continue to improve them, but we do see cases. Last week, one very large volume lab said they had to change their IP address because they were reconfiguring their internal network. And it took a while to get them reconnected. And why should that be? I don't know. But so even relatively, what should be relatively small changes can sometimes throw you off. But yeah, we keep an eye on that, and that's important. Yes.
Last question.
I can't. What's the percentage of labs that send us the ELR? I mean, the thing is. I don't know yet, because we've just started that process. We've just started it with a few laboratories, so I don't know yet. I'm hoping that it's simple enough, it will take them a few minutes to run a report and email it to us, that it won't be onerous for them and they'll do it. But I don't know what. I think we need to move on to the next speaker, but I think most laboratories have mechanisms. Once they get it set up, they have a mechanism to run a report and send the results, and that's what they have to do. So that shouldn't be a lot of time. Okay.
Thank you, Ray.